Okay, well, what did it mean for kind of your own, what did it mean for the kinds of questions that you asked at the bench at the time, as well as your own kind of personal career ambitions that you went 2 to 3 years without any NIH funding?
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that last part of the...
What did it mean to you, both in terms of the kinds of questions you asked?
And yeah.
This is to reiterate a few things that you've already said, as well as your own kind of... your own ideas of how well you can compete within your field as a career scientist when you went out... went for 2 to 3 years without any federal lead.
Right, federal funding. So, although I didn't have federal funding, but I had enough funding.
Okay.
As I said, you know, $200,000 from American Cancer Society was more than what I had from the NIH. And so I was able to do what I wanted to do. And at least money was so far, fortunately, I cannot predict future. At least till now has not been a problem. I could do, you know, experiments and so federal funding was not an essential part. But then I do believe that I should be able to get back funds from NIH. With things that I have developed in during the last 3 years, they're looking very good, and I have a strong feeling that I should be able to get it. So.
And what happens if you don't?
American Cancer Society still. Hopefully fund me. And you're right. What would happen if I don't get money from anywhere? And that would be a real nightmare. And I do not know. I do not know how to answer that question.
Okay. Well, what difference does it make in terms of the kinds of questions you ask, in terms of the kind of science that you do, when the money comes from a private source like the American Cancer Society versus a federally funded grant?
You know, only difference might be that American Cancer Society renewals are quicker, whereas NIH, the renewals are like after 4 years, 5 years. The funding periods are longer. So for the NIH, money gives you a lot more security. You're seeing 4 or 5 years of research, whereas ACS is funding you for 3 years. So it is the time of when you have to renew. Other than that, I do not see a huge difference. Yes, I mean, there's always a question, what if I don't renew my grant? And I do not know how to answer that. And then I have to assume that I will be able to get funding from other sources. That becomes a difficult part of doing things with peace in mind.
Yeah. Okay. Well, knowing that the American Cancer Society wants to fund grants that are going to lead to rather new treatments, a better understanding of cancer, better treatments of cancer. How much does knowing that this is a clinically driven foundation influence how you write the grant, how you think about the project, how you develop the questions, what areas you're going to pursue?
In fact, very little, though. The reviewers are, the study sections, the reviewers and the study section I go to, are they are not clinicians.
Okay.
They are just like a nice study section of for basic science, and then it is, you need to fill out forms where you say how this is related to cancer, your work, and you have to explain that, and often you have to do it in lay terms, lay language. That's all you need to do, and it is kind of easy for me to do because some of the things I do are directly related to cancer. So I never had problem with that. They are clinically driven, but they do support, you know, basic research. In fact, they have more, I think they have more study sections for basic research than clinical research.
And what does it mean for science when the case that, a case like yours, where you have a proven track record and you think this is an interesting area, but you aren't getting any funding for it, and you have to make these decisions and go with a project that does look promising, and drop another project that potentially had, you know, rewards? What does it mean for science when good science is just not going to get funded?
Well, yeah, that is always a loss. Always a loss. And then it happens particularly in my kind of situation where I have to think about how much resources I have. For example, there are labs who are funded like $1 million a year, they don't have to worry about these kind of things. And you can take a totally obscure observation and develop totally new things in that kind of lab. So these kind of things are more practical in labs which has unlimited resources, like Howard Hughes labs. That's how you can pursue those kind of things. In my kind of setup, had to be something that, this is something I realize now, that it had to be something that I can convince the reviewers for funding. Otherwise, it is not going to be worthwhile for me to study, unless I am able to shift myself to a point or become a Howard Hughes in basic at some point. And then I will have the luxury to pursue those kind of things. For me, though, spending some money and some people's effort in the lab trying to study that RNA binding protein and stopping it after 3 years, what that meant was that became a loss, because that money I invested, that the people's effort which was invested, the ideas that went into it and everything, because it was not taken to a finish line, it is a loss. That is something I realized. and I am not going to do. It took. I was immature at that point, I must say. So it needed a little bit of growing up to understand what is real life in terms of real terms. You know, you cannot pursue this kind of studies because they may not be funded.
And so how do you balance this perhaps zeal that you have said, you know, has driven you and has accounted for some of your excess, this, and the ideal of science that no matter what you're looking at, if it's happening in the cell, it's important, versus this reality that you have to mature and somehow in this world of science and realize that it's not just about pursuing knowledge, it's not just about doing good science, it's about hedging your bets and taking your calculated risks and playing the grantsmanship game.
That's right, that's right.
So how do you balance these ideals versus realities?
Well, it is not a difficult thing to do. One thing which is obvious is that this is still, I think, is right. That is, there are so many important things to do. And then, so some things you think important, 20 other reviewers do not think that's important. It's probably wise for you not to study that. But then there are other important things which not only you think important, but 15 other reviewers also think important. Given that these are all important things, it is wise to just study that which something you can sell to the other reviewers. And then that's kind of mentality I have now growing, that at least at this point when I have to count on my resources and count on how productive I am compared to how much funds I have. I had to, you know, with the kinds of funds I have to decide whether I should do an experiment or not. Because many experiments are risky. And I think that is that risk worth this much money? So I have now cut down on riskiest experiments, which are potentially, in fact, potentially better than some of the experiments I do. But then this, you know, with limited funds, that the scope of science, scope of discovery, is also curtailed a little bit, and I don't think you can do anything about it.
Could you do better science if you were somewhere else, or if perhaps you were appointed as a Howard Hughes medical?
I strongly feel that way. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and yes. It takes me. I was talking with a friend of mine, who's a Howard Hughes member. I was telling him the kind of effort that he spends to publish a cell paper. I have to spend same kind of effort to publish a paper in MCB.
Which means when you publish in cell versus MCV.
It just means that you do not attract that many audience. You know, Cell yeah. has more audience than MCB. But, you know, these are good, both of them publish good quality science. It's just that the number of audience you where you're advertising your science. This is one way of looking at it, advertising your science. And then so yes, I think if I go to a situation like many of my friends are, I would do much better science. I have done that, and I can do that. From here, it is difficult. This is the kind of place. Well, then it, you know, I will. You know, this is the kind of place that this university, this medical school, used to be a teaching institution. The main purpose was to teach medical students. Research was, you know, well, okay, if you have interest, if you can get money, do it. It is changing slowly. So it is still not a very attractive research institute. So we do not attract good co-workers. As a result, this is a difficult place. You know, it's not just ideas. These are experimental science. You can have all the good ideas, but if the person, your colleague, doesn't have good hands or good, do not generate good reagents, then ideas go to drain, and you cannot do anything about it. So this is a difficult place. Difficult in terms of competing, being so. What I had to do is that's why, you know, what I realized that just to be able to keep myself above the water, what I have to do is do something else, which the big labs are not doing, something which is still very important. And then I am doing it, and then I'm hoping that at some point I would be able to get out of this type of situation where I'm considered as a teacher. You know, I teach a lot.
How much do you teach?
I teach like 30 hours of, you know, lecturing, teach in various departments in many courses, which is good and bad. Good meaning, I read a lot. I keep myself updated in many areas of science, but then takes me away from my research a lot.
And do you teach undergraduates at all?
No,
or
no.
Primarily
PhD and MD students.
Okay. To go back a little bit, and is why did you come here to the University of Illinois after your postdoc, and why do you stay?
It had to do with my wife's job.
Okay.
Two jobs.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, we ended up in the same lab doing postdoc, doing same things. You know, what happens when a husband and wife, you know, are working in the same lab, you go home, talk about science. Talk about projects and talk about science, and then and next day when you go to the lab, try to do that. And then, so basically, even it started from Nevin's lab, basically, the point came that I was generating reagents, she was running experiments, or she was generating reagents, I was running experiments. We're doing same thing. And when these two people looking for job, it's an impossible situation. Most universities, the search committees, they don't want to. Now I myself serve in two search committees, and I can see the problem. and although I sympathize with these applicants, but I can see the problems that the search committees face when there's a husband-wife applicants. This bunch of those are all job applicants, and then I easy to find husband-wife in there, and they're looking for job. In same university, it is like impossible. Same town is a possibility. So whenever I went for job interview, I mentioned, and it looked like, you know, the search committee, it's just in front of you. They expressed that is such a, off in many places. I remember that they became just unhappy that they're going to lose me. They cannot recruit me. So that was a problem. And in this place, what happened was, although it was quite early during our job hunting period, what happened is, I had a friend from Rockefeller who was in this department. So he really wanted to get me here. And so he talked to the chairman. So the chairman did, he found a job for my wife in the College of Dentistry. And so that's how, you know, we ended up here. In fact, David Levy was trying to get me to NYU at that point. Would have been much nicer for me to get there. But then, they didn't have space for me. The timing was, I had to wait 6 or 8 months for a lab space, so that was a problem for me. But this place, you know, I had a friend here who's a good scientist, who was, again, common friends, David Levy and me. And so, although I, when I was looking for a job, I did not hear about this place. You know, this university is not known for research at that time. It was an acceptable, and they made a very nice offer. They gave me everything I wanted, and my wife wanted. So it worked out nicely at that point. Well, if that explains why I'm here.
Yeah, okay. So why do you stay?
Why did I stay? I wanted to get tenure before I moved.
Okay. Have you gotten tenure?
Yes.
Last year?
Yes. Yeah. So now why am I still here? I'm waiting for my wife to get tenure.
Okay. She hasn't gotten tenure yet.
No, she's going through this year. She's... So that is something, you know, like a year from now, I will decide how long I want to stay here. This university has plus things to consider. You know, when you're not thinking science, you're thinking job. This is not bad because my 9 months salary is guaranteed. Even if I don't do anything.
Okay.
This person who's here, the professor, I don't want this to be recorded, sorry. So that is the plus thing, that your 9 month salary is guaranteed in this university. There are other, other universities where there is a tenure thing, but they don't guarantee a significant part of your salary, although you have a tenure. So I do not know what tenure means there. So there are some good things too here. So I have to balance this and then see if I go to another place, scientifically, how much I will gain, and then because I am going to lose some of this, guarantee.
And you're guaranteed 100% of your salary. You don't have to get any of your salary out of your grants.
Right.
That's great. That's highly unusual.
Yeah.
For a few scholars. And then how much in indirect cost does the university take out of your grant to cover overhead and things?
Well, this comes from the granting agency, so it doesn't bother me. So the indirect cost is the other part of the grant, which I never see anywhere.
Okay. And how does it look for your wife to get tenure? How is her work going?
This year I think she's looking very good, and we just have to wait and see. And there are so many things involved in tenure. It is... it is like a torture. Mine went through like a butter. I got very good letters from people, and which is an important part. They ask these reviewers that, are you going to tenure this person in your university? which is a difficult question when someone in Harvard is saying this.
Right.
Or even UCLA is saying this, because this is an applicant from UIC, which is not a famous place for research and things like that. Fortunately, because I published, I kept myself up, in publishing and in good journals, and then it went through, and I got very good letters, and then, so, as I said, for my wife, things, and it has to, we have to wait and see.
And what does it mean once you both have tenure?
Then we have to really sit down and think. Obviously, I want to move on to a situation where I can at least attract good people to my lab. So, for example, what I might want to do is go to another university in Chicago, where I probably have I'll be able to attract better people. That is a consideration. Also, other consideration would be if, for example, if I get a very good offer from somewhere else. Whether can I convince her to move with a less attractive job for her? That would be something that we have to talk. We still collaborate doing science in some projects, and we know that both of us understand that. This is a difficult place to do good science, and so given doing science, doing good science is the primary goal. If we get opportunities somewhere where we think we'll be able to do good science, we might sacrifice something and then just move. And that's something I'm talking, you know, it's a future thing, and then
I'm probably going to be jumping around a little bit as we kind of fit everything into this session. But I'll go ahead and ask you a couple of questions. It's not unusual, so unusual, that a peace scholar is married to another scientist. It doesn't come up so often, though, that they are collaborate so closely. And you had already mentioned that you go home and talk science at the dinner table. It naturally happened that way, being postdocs together in Nevin's lab. Issues of authorship and kind of proprietary rights over who did what in an experiment causes problems with complete strangers, let alone people who share their professional and personal lives. And how do you two arrive at these decisions as who's going to be first author, who's going to be last author?
Right. Well, we had a very good setup in Nevin's lab. That is, you know, in one paper she's first author, in another paper I'm first author. No matter where so often she was a loser, and the other case I was a loser, you know. But that's how it was. If this paper she's the first author, next paper I'm the first author. Because we were doing things equally, there's no way you can divide these things. That is a problem. And that's how we accepted it. In one meeting, I presented the stuff she presented in the next meeting. Often she probably felt bad. I probably felt bad, but then that's the only way we could do it. After moving here, it became a lot easier. Became a lot easier in the sense that we started doing things, although the first paper from here was again together. She was the first author, I was the last author. But then, we knew, I was the corresponding author, and so I didn't lose any credit for that. But then we slowly started working on slightly different things. It was important for her and for me to work on different things. Although there are overlaps, but we still publish certain things together. But the main projects are different now. That had caused problem in her tenure committee, that many of her papers are with me, and then so after her initial review, she has now published several papers from her lab by herself. So.
And was that an issue in your tenure committee?
No, I mean, he was not.
And why do you think that is the case?
What happened is I published more than she did. As a result, many papers, she was just, and the project became different. She was not an author in many papers. So that problem did not arise in my case. In her case, the problem was the College of Dentistry is worse than this. You know, the question is, how low can you go? Often we wonder in a scientific environment. Her situation is even worse than mine. There's no graduate student she could get. She had to depend on postdocs, and then being able to recruit good posters. So her situation was a lot more difficult than mine. There was a period she was not productive at all. She had to struggle, do things by herself, and then try to develop things. And then now it looks much better for her. And in fact, her tenure committees feel very strongly that things might just go through this year, and just have to wait and see.
And how much do you think gender has played a role in kind of the differences in your experiences in science and tenure cases and her experience in science and tenure cases?
Well, you know, her tenure committee, as well as the chairman, complained. We had this, you know, what happened, if my daughter was, you know, she was not healthy when she used to suffer a lot from cold, you know, like tonsil. And so often my wife would just, you know, whenever daughter was sick, she's the one.
Okay.
We didn't divide equally at that thing. So that was, I was told by my chairman that was something like an unfair thing that I did to her.
Your chairman told you that?
Yes.
And what was your response?
My response was, if you think that way, it is. And now I tend to share more equally, I would say.
Well, you were raised in a traditional culture where, and being the oldest son, you know, you had expected roles, a certain role expected of you, and you had older sisters who had different expectations. And how much are your own attitudes, current attitudes of, you know, the roles of men and women, been carried forward because of this traditional background? And your mother, you know, your grandmother's names, you aren't quite sure of the spelling. Your mother didn't have the influence in terms of this in the same way that your father did in your life, whether directing it positively or negatively. And your own kind of attitudes towards the roles that women are expected to play, even with your, not only your wife, but graduate students, say graduate students and postdocs who choose to pursue careers in science and pursue family obligations.
Well, you know, this is something, you know, I must say that I am still working on in the sense, gender has not been a problem for me. I treat a student as student. When there's a female student, I had to be a little careful, tell her, look, close the, when you're alone at late nights, close the door. I didn't say to a male student, and often I found myself that I'm taking maybe an extra care to female students, which they did not mind. So when it came to students, I had absolutely no problem, and otherwise I just treated them like student. Gender was simply not an issue. I look at a person as a person. That's how I deal with people. When it came to family life, Yes, I was happier when I saw, or oftentimes I gave importance to my work, that I have to go to work, I have to get this done. I have done that, and I think that I could have shared that equally without losing much of what I achieved. But I did it. I mean, it's, right now I try to share more equally, as I said, and I see that I know women are in fact one of my students so far. Now I've graduated 4 students, and 1 female and 3 male, and that female student, she probably published as many papers as the other best student, male student. So I had 2 real good students, one of this female and 1 a Russian student. This female American student, she published as many papers as the other Russian student. And she has gone on to good places. In terms of ability, she was as able as any male student that I had. And frankly speaking, I do not see any difference between abilities.
And what about the situation when, you know, your female graduate student says, you ask that, you know, these reagents need to be mixed up, and she says, I'm sorry, my kid's sick, I've got to go home, I'll do it first thing in the morning. Kind of thing.
It hasn't happened to me. My female students were younger.
Okay.
Now that I've seen one of my daughter growing, I know the problem of a human life.
Yeah.
In a more matured way, I can deal, because my postdoc, you know, they. Take off for their, and I do not mind. I can see, although when I was a postdoc, I do not know that I would have done that. I was, as I said, everything was kind of secondary to me. I was more like doing things in the lab was the primary. It still is. Doing things in the lab is the primary goal in my still is, but I have now been able to take out time. Like there was a time when I was a postdoc, or even initial period of me as an assistant professor here, every second, every minute in my lab sort of counted. Now I can see that is not that important. I can make up for it and still take care of my daughter. So that has changed a little bit.
And what expectations do you have for your daughter in terms of what she should do with her life?
Well, you know, frankly speaking, I definitely want her to be an independent person. Doesn't matter what career she takes. But then, now you probably will get me for this. I didn't mention to her that I would like to see her to become a surgeon.
No way! And why is that?
And I do not know why is that, but I think that's one way you help people. You know, they are the people who directly help people.
Did you tell your father you said this?
No. No. But I do not know whether, you know, I am not strong. I'm not going to push her. I will encourage her. I think that you know, that these surgeons, they cure diseases. They take out something and then something that, you know, in another person cannot do. I cannot do.
Okay, let me flip this over.